Thanks, Papadarka. Somebody drew my attention to something I said yesterday in the talk about Windy Miller. I didn't realise that Windy Miller was, you know, what I was trying to say, that Miller Repper, it doesn't mean Miller as in somebody who grinds corn. It means the cotton-clad Miller. And I thought Windy Miller was a way of talking about people who grind corn. But actually, the character Windy Miller was from a 1970s television children's television programme called Trumpton, and Windy Miller was a character. I thought it was a common term for Millers, but actually it's not. It's very specific to... Where are we going? Anyway, I just wanted to... Sorry about that obscure reference. So this morning we're concerned with going for refuge and generating the mind of enlightenment. So I don't know about any of you, but when I began to get involved in Buddhism, family and old friends sometimes used to accuse me of being escapist. Being a Buddhist, I was told, was running away from life. Not that they knew anything about Buddhism, of course. I mean, they hadn't studied it in any way. They hadn't even read a book on it. And they hadn't even really talked to me about it. But the image of it, I suppose, was something otherworldly, uninvolved and uninterested in the messy, and involved with and uninterested in the messy bits of life. Or I was escapist because I didn't want to live life in the normal way. I didn't want a career. I didn't want to get married. I didn't want to have children. I didn't want to go on holidays, and I didn't want to be retired, etc., etc. So I was somehow running away from reality, burying my head in the sand, or I was frightened of responsibility, all these things. I was an escapist. That was the accusation. And maybe you've encountered this yourself. Maybe people even sort of said it to you when you told them that you wouldn't be seeing the new year in the usual way, you know, that you weren't going to get drunk, and you would instead be on a retreat where there was no television, no drink, no meat, no women, and you'd be spending your days sitting in silence, talking about Buddhism, listening to lectures, washing up, and doing nothing. So in that way, you're running away, you're avoiding something, you're escaping from something, you're an escapist. And of course, it has to be said, it can happen. We can and do use religion, even Buddhism, as a way of avoiding reality, avoiding facing up to ourselves. That does happen, facing up to our life. We can use Buddhism in this way. But Buddhist tradition would say that actually, all the time, everybody is running away from the reality of their situation in one way or another. Everybody is trying to escape, or rather, actually, everyone is an escapist. By escapist, I mean someone avoiding the reality of where they are by pretending that everything is all right, by somehow papering over the cracks that are starting to appear, or actually are evident, or the cracks that you can sense that are just, you know, breaking through. Yesterday we heard Gampopa tell us that the nature of samsara, the nature of life, is emptiness. It's insubstantial. It has no fixed and permanent core in any of it. We ourselves don't have a fixed and permanent core. There is no fixed and permanent core in anything. There's no fixed and permanent core in other people. If we look, says Gampopa, from the bottom to the top of the cosmos, if we could, we will not find any permanent being or entity at all. Everything is flowing ever onwards. Life is constantly slipping through our hands. And we are ourselves always living in the face of death. We are a being towards death. And the time of that death is unknown and uncertain. Everything is actually incredibly fragile. So naturally then, we look for certainty. Of course we do. Something, someone, some people, some being to hold on to make some ideas, to make sense of all this. Much of the time we don't even notice that we're doing this. It's so instinctive. It's part of survival. It's a survival mechanism, of course. Sometimes, though, something happens. Something kind of breaks through. We lose someone that we love very, very much. Suddenly, they just leave us. They either walk away from us, or we have a row and they go, or they lose interest in us, or they die. Or there's some event in life, something happens, some great tragedy or catastrophe, you know, some natural event like the tsunami we had a couple of years ago. Or we're just getting older. And suddenly we notice we're old. We're not young anymore. We're old. Or we start getting ill. You know, we have a bad illness. Or a brush with death. Or maybe people start behaving very differently. People who we thought were our friends suddenly aren't our friends anymore. We're no fun. So whatever, the usual points of reference are just not there. They seem to be kind of crumbling. And the usual points of reference don't seem to make much sense of what is happening. Our usual sources of security are not sources of security anymore. The usual explanations don't make sense. They don't work. So this desire for security, this basic existential search for security, this concern to establish security, to find it, to maintain it, Buddhism approaches head on. We are all looking for refuge. We want refuge. We want things, people, places that give security, that give meaning, that give safety. This is very basic in human life indeed. We like to think, of course, how independent and how individual we are. But, you know, really, is it so? Is that actually the case? Are we that, you know, rugged individual depicted in so many adverts? You know, I always think of Levi adverts here. You know, that rugged individual who puts on that fantastic pair of jeans and he's, usually a very sexy, handsome, you know, young man, young god. And, of course, you look around, everybody's wearing these jeans. You know, it's a uniform. But so are we really this kind of rugged individual? In chapter 8 of the Jewel Ornament, Gampopa takes up this issue of refuge, the need for refuge, and the establishment of the best refuge, the refuge that's in tune with, that is the expression of reality. And Gampopa looks at the topic of refuge in the context of describing the means, the way to attain enlightenment, to attain liberation. He says, one of the problems we have is that we are ignorant of the way to attain enlightenment. So the rest of the Jewel Ornament of Liberation is describing the means whereby we can attain enlightenment. And that way, that means, starts with refuge, with going for refuge. It starts with this because going for refuge is the time-honoured Buddhist way of describing making a decisive commitment to the spiritual life, to the attainment of enlightenment. And this way of speaking in terms of going for refuge, goes back to the Buddha himself, goes back to the earliest and most ancient text, to the origins of Buddhism, and to something that was originally a spontaneous expression. It's quite clear from looking at the ancient texts that originally someone expressed their commitment to the spiritual life using this language of going for refuge. And the stories that you get go something like, someone meets the Buddha. They might be interested in the spiritual life, might not be. They just sort of bump into him one day. And something happens. There's a communication. The Buddha talks about his experience. He talks about the Dharma. He kind of responds to them and, you know, what's going on for them. And sometimes it can happen that the person is deeply moved by the teaching and by the communication. And the effect is so strong that they see something. They see reality in some way or another. They see this, they have this glimpse of liberation. And they're so deeply moved by that that they break into, well, it's almost like they break into poetry. They say things like, that which was knocked down has now been set up right. So they have a sense of rightness. Before, things were kind of broken and they weren't set up right. But now, things are right. They say it's as if the way's been revealed, where before there was no way, there was no path. So they have that sense of that bewilderment coming to an end. They say, it's like a lamp has been lit in the darkness so that those with eyes can actually see form. So there's this sense of coming out of darkness, the darkness of ignorance. You know, and maybe you felt something like this when you discovered the Dharma. A lot of people say, and it can, you know, I know sound like a cliche, but they really do mean it. They say when they encounter the Dharma, when they have that first thrilling, you know, encounter with the Dharma, there's a sense of coming home, a sense of discovering their language, discovering their people, that sort of thing. There's this strong emotional response, and there's a deep shift in the centre of their gravity, and they start coming to rest on what they regard as their deepest values. And in the ancient text, they then say, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, to the Buddha for refuge I go, Dhammang Saranam Gacchami, to the Dharma for refuge I go, and Sangham Saranam Gacchami, to the Sangha for refuge I go. And then they say, as long as breath lasts, I will go for refuge. These are very powerful accounts in the old texts. So instead of trying to find security in essentially impermanent, painful and insubstantial things, one moves towards and comes to rest, establish oneself on the deepest spiritual values. Values that stand face to face with the impermanent and insubstantial nature of things, that aren't a sort of way of avoiding those things. So Gampopa follows a venerable tradition when he speaks of going for refuge. And the first thing he does is look very briefly at some of the things that we often take as refuges, but which aren't actually. So Gampopa asks, it may be asked whether we should take refuge in such asylums as the powerful deities Brahma, Vishnu, Mahadeva, and others, or in the mighty Nagas who live in the mountains, rocks, lakes, trees, and other places of our country. The answer is that since they are all unable to protect us, they provide no refuge. So Gampopa says that the gods of Hinduism, Brahma, Vishnu, Mahadeva, are not a refuge. So a creator god in any form that he's described is not a refuge. Buddhism doesn't regard that there is such thing as a creator god who is all powerful. They regard that as a delusion. They do acknowledge that, yes, there are these gods. They're quite happy, the Buddhist tradition, to accept that. But they're incredibly deluded, thinking that they are creator gods. That's all a terrible misunderstanding. There's some really quite amusing stories in the Buddhist text. It's like something out of a Philip Pullman novel where, you know, a god sort of has to admit that he's not all powerful and he's not a creator when somebody's having a vision of him. It's all a terrible misunderstanding. These gods are all part of the wheel. They're all impermanent and deluded. Gampopa also speaks about the Nagas. The Nagas are the powerful gods of the water and the waters and the soil and the mountains of Tibet. So these are the deities associated with the land, the spirits of place. Again, traditional Buddhism operates in an environment densely populated by different gods and spirits. You know, I remember at our retreat centre in India, I don't know if it's still there, I haven't been there for a long time, our lovely retreat centre at Bhaja near Pune. There's a corner of a field, a local farmer's field, where there's a very, very old tree. It's a lovely old tree, and it's been there, it seems, since, well, almost, it seems, the beginning of things. And there's a very particular atmosphere there. And the locals, you can see that they make offerings there. They've set up a stone there and painted it with vermilion paint. and they offer flowers there. I've even seen them sacrificing a hen there. So this is a kind of local field, not the local Buddhists, I should say, local Hindus. So this is a local field god, a kind of tree spirit of some kind. Well, you know, it's okay that there are these presences around. You can sometimes feel them deep in the country and on the mountains sometimes. But according to Buddhist tradition, these figures, these spirits of place, are not a source of ultimate security because they're impermanent and because they don't embody necessarily deep spiritual values. So these gods are just part of the impermanent and insubstantial world. They're a different aspect of it. They seem to provide sometimes magical protection, but they're not actually something that you can rely on in the end. Spirits of place are notoriously fickle. Sometimes, of course, the Buddha can be turned into something like this, just another god who you pray to and you're passive in relation to. And it's very important to understand that the Buddha is definitely not, for Buddhists, their god, and he's the best and most powerful. That's not the true understanding of the nature of the Buddha. The Buddha represents a completely different dimension. That is why he's a refuge. And we'll see what that dimension is a little later, because Gampopa mentions another set of beings that we look to for refuge, for ultimate security. He says, should we then take refuge in father and mother, in friends and other persons who are dear to us, and rejoice at our well-being? The answer is that they are unable to protect us, as is stated in the ancient text. Father or mother are no refuge for you, neither are friends nor relatives, having forsaken you. They depart just as they like. So Gampopa asks why can't they be a refuge? Well, because they're not in the end reliable. They leave us sooner or later. They're impermanent beings. They are also, he says, frightened and subject to suffering. So how can they be a refuge? So what he means is they're not enlightened. They're still bound up with the world of bewilderment and suffering. So how can you rely on them? Now, at this point, I think it's very important to say that Gampopa is not promoting a cynical and negative view of others. You know, you can meet people sometimes. Maybe you get into moods like this yourself. You know, other people, they're just useless. They're greedy, stupid, unreliable. I'm not going to bother with them. And, you know, we sort of cut ourselves off from other people in this sort of really conceited, kind of arrogant space. Well, this can be just an expression of our disappointment and our ill will and cynicism and our disconnection from others. It's a lonely, miserable kind of state. Gampopa is definitely not promoting that. You have to remember that the chapter before the chapter on refuge is on love and compassion, where he makes it absolutely clear that love and compassion is absolutely essential to spiritual development. It's the way we overcome self-isolation and selfishness. Earlier on in chapter 3, he talked about the importance of spiritual friends as the contributory cause of our spiritual development. So we need to be with spiritual friends. So Gampopa is not preaching the cultivation of misanthropy. He's just making the obvious point. You can't rely on others to provide endlessly security, happiness, satisfaction, meaning and value. You cannot do that. It doesn't work. He mentions family, relations and friends. And this is actually very, very radical, because Gampopa is speaking in the context of traditional society, of very close-knit family groups and clan groups. So this is a very, very powerful teaching. It's very hard perhaps for us to relate to this, because the family and the clan provide everything. They provide connection. They provide social security. But here Gampopa is saying, well, they're not a refuge. They can't endlessly provide you with meaning and value. Perhaps we could approach thinking about this in terms of our expectations of others. That's the way we kind of turn others into a refuge at the expectations of parents and wives and lovers and friends, and even people in the Sangha, social institutions. We expect a great deal sometimes and get resentful if it's not given to us exactly how it's supposed to be given. We think it's supposed to be given. And we cling to these things, and we hate them too, because we cling to them. It's funny, when I was preparing this talk and I'd got to this point, a friend of mine, somebody who lives here, came in, and he'd just been talking to a friend on the telephone who was in a bit of a state, a close friend of his, because she'd just had a big fallout with her father. And he was kind of outlining, you know, how he had to kind of talk her down. And you could sort of feel, as he explained what she was saying, the sort of, you know, her father was a refuge, and, you know, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't good enough, and, you know, all this sort of thing. You could think, oh, there you are. Attachment, disappointment, get so mixed up, don't they, in close relationships, because we've over-invested. We've made them a refuge. We don't see them as they are. We don't actually appreciate them. To appreciate others, what do you need? Yes, you need that metta, that clean, clear, appreciative friendliness and loving kindness. And you need to find yourself a true refuge. Not in them, but something deeply reliable, which has been to some extent internalized. In fact, to sustain such appreciation of others, you need a refuge in yourself. So Gampopa turns to the true refuge, the true refuges, what we can actually rely upon. And these are traditionally, first of all, the Buddha, the enlightened one. Why? Because the enlightened one has attained the enlightened state. He embodies the enlightened state, which is complete freedom from suffering. Secondly, the Dharma, because it provides the way to the attainment of that state of enlightenment. So that can be a refuge. We can rely on that to take us to freedom, the refuge that is freedom from all suffering. And thirdly, the Sangha. The Sangha can be a refuge because the Sangha are those that help you practice that Dharma that leads to enlightenment. So going to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha for refuge provides you with protection, because they become a refuge. It makes you, in fact, fearless. There's a kind of maxim. He who goes for refuge to the three jewels will gain fearlessness. Something perhaps to meditate and reflect upon. I really like these things in Gampopa. He just gives you a few lines sometimes, which I think are intended to be aphorisms that you go away and turn over in your mind. He who goes for refuge to the three jewels will gain fearlessness. So Gampopa then explores the nature of these refuges in more detail. First of all, the jewel of the Buddha. They're called jewels, by the way, because they're regarded as the most precious values by Buddhists. You have the three jewels depicted there on the shrine, just below the Buddha. So the jewel of the Buddha is endowed with the excellences of renunciation, wisdom and spiritual greatness. This is what Gampopa says. The Buddha is endowed with the excellences of renunciation, wisdom and spiritual greatness. Greatness here meaning compassion for others and all the other qualities that pour out of wisdom. But I must stress, the Buddha here is not being regarded as a totem, as another kind of god, as a kind of badge, a slogan. The Buddha, we can say, is the full expression of our Buddha potential that we spoke of yesterday. So going for refuge to the Buddha means placing on your heart upon, your being upon, the spiritual ideal, the spiritual principle of wisdom and compassion. It's you, going for refuge is you emerging into, becoming the refuge, becoming wisdom and compassion and spiritual greatness. So we turn towards that in all that we do. And this is, by the way, why we have images of the Buddha, why we have paintings and symbols of the Buddha. And Gampopa mentions these in his text. They're reminders of that refuge, and they're there to inspire us. Secondly, there's the jewel of the Dharma. by the jewel of the Dharma, Gampopa means the teachings of the Buddha, and Gampopa mentions the full range of the Buddha's teaching. But he makes the very practical point that those teachings describe the path to nirvana, the enlightened state. So to go for refuge to the Dharma is not holding Buddhist dogmas. If you're holding a Buddhist dogma, it's not Buddhism. If you turn Buddhist ideas into dogmas, you've actually missed the point. Or it's not about being able to rattle off Buddhist lists and kind of having Buddhist slogans. I remember once in a seminar with Sangharakshita, our teacher, I was very young at the time, when he was asking us questions about, well, why do we need to renounce and give up attachment to material things? I said, because they're impermanent. And he said, well, that's a good Buddhist answer. You know, he wanted me to think. He didn't want me to come out with some sort of Buddhist slogan. So it means being committed to the path of Buddhist practice and being committed to realizing the truth yourself as taught by the Buddha. It means engaging with and exploring the Buddha's teaching. Thirdly, there's the jewel of the Sangha, and there's two levels to this. First of all, there is what's known as the Arya Sangha, the noble Sangha, the spiritual community of those towering spiritual individuals who are irreversible in their spiritual attainment. They've entered the stream that just flows to nirvana. So it's being inspired by the great disciples of the Buddha. They're the example to us that the path to enlightenment can be followed and realized. Secondly, the Sangha is the community of ordinary human beings committed to the spiritual path, who support you, inspire you in your spiritual endeavor. Gampopa probes the refuges even more deeply. And some of this probing of the nature of the refuges becomes rather technical and complex, so I don't really want to go into all this, but the basic point seems to be is as your spiritual practice unfolds and deepens, you see the refuges ever more deeply. You see them in their ultimate spiritual depth, which means, of course, you becoming the refuges, you becoming the refuge. As Sangharakshita once said, the ultimate going for refuge is enlightenment itself. Gampopa even goes so far as to say that actually there is only one refuge. And what is that refuge? He says, it's Buddhahood itself. It's the Buddha. In the ultimate sense, he's quoting here, in the ultimate sense, the refuge for the world is Buddhahood alone. Why? Because, says Gampopa, the Buddha possesses the Dharmakaya. We've had this term yesterday. The body of reality. The Dharmakaya is the Buddha's nature, the Buddha's enlightenment nature, reality itself, without beginning or end, and completely pure. So what Gampopa is describing here is the ultimate transcendental principle of Buddhahood and enlightenment. Transcendental in the sense that it's beyond all words, all ideas, all forms, all expression. It's luminous and radiant with spiritual quality. That is the ultimate refuge, because the Dharma in the form of words and letters that expresses that, well, that will fade away. Words and letters fade away. So how can those words and letters be a refuge? And the Sangha, who are the followers of the Buddha, well, they depend on that refuge. They find their refuge in that nature of Buddhahood itself. So in the end, the only refuge is enlightenment itself. So some might think, and some people do think, unfortunately, getting well ahead of themselves, so let's not bother with anything else then. We'll just be in touch with that pure enlightenment principle. Which, of course, they just hold as an idea. So, just in case people make that mistake, Gampopa moves on to describe the ceremony of going for refuge. So it's very clear that we need to work on that basic practical level if we are to realise enlightenment as the sole refuge. It makes it very clear that we need to make an actual commitment to a clear spiritual goal, the Buddha as the embodiment of wisdom and compassion. We need to take up an actual path of practice, which is the Dharma, which involves study, reflection and meditation, and making it an actual living experience. And we need to go for refuge to the Sangha. In other words, connecting with those who've realised the Dharma to different degrees and being part of that community ourselves. And Gampopa describes different ceremonies of refuge, and one of them he describes as taking place over 3 days, so it's quite elaborate. It involves such things as asking the teacher for refuge. This is a very, very important point. It's not just, the refuge isn't sort of, you know, given, you know, passively. You know, you know, a Buddhist teacher turns up one day and says, hey, I'll give you the refuge. You have to want it. You go. It's your individual decision. And there's a thorough training that goes with it. In our own order, training for ordination, the heart of which is going for refuge, involves a lot of training, and the refuge ceremonies themselves take place over a couple of nights, a couple of days, in the context of an intensive retreat. Gampopa reminds us as well to be aware in all this of the ultimate spiritual depths of the refuges. So whilst we take on the refuges that are sort of near to us, that we can actually engage with, there is also a verse that he gives where we have to realise as well that the refuges are everywhere. When we realise the empty and insubstantial nature of everything, well, everything actually becomes a refuge. Reality becomes a refuge. So it's very important not to understand this language of refuge as describing some other place. It's not a kind of Buddhist heaven, and the Buddha isn't a Buddhist god. Going for refuge isn't just a ceremony. The ceremony marks something, witnesses a process, a movement in your being that continues as long as you have breath, or as it's also said, it continues until you actually attain enlightenment, until you are the refuge, until you are a refuge for others. The aim of Buddhist practice is to be a source yourself of ultimate reliability to others, a source of real spiritual quality and meaning and value for others. So the practice of refuge is to keep turning moment by moment to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, so that you can become more and more reliable as a human being, as a spiritual source even. So Gampopa speaks of the training that comes from going for refuge, and he mentions things like not relying on the gods. There's no need, because you have the enlightenment principle vividly before you. Not relying on false philosophies and wrong views, because you don't need that. You've got the Dharma, so you don't need to get involved in the confusion and proliferation of false philosophy. And most importantly of all, he quotes a text which says, he who goes for refuge to the noble Dharma does not think of hurting and destroying. He who goes for refuge to the noble Dharma does not think of hurting and destroying. If you go for refuge, that expresses itself as non-harm and non-violence and the other basic Buddhist precepts, which all express non-harm and non-violence. So going for refuge involves changes in your behaviour. A difference must make a difference. So you would be vegetarian, you'd have great care for the environment, you would eschew harsh and devious speech, you wouldn't steal, and so on and so forth. You take on what's called technically a pratimoksha, which is an ethical code, which is a path to liberation. A pratimoksha describes the behaviour, the methods, an entire and total way of life that's dedicated to liberation. A liberation not only for oneself, but for and with all living beings. And this brings us to chapter 9 of the Dual Ornament of Liberation. And chapter 9 and 10, indeed, of the Dual Ornament of Liberation describes the arising of the mind and heart completely focused on enlightenment, what's known in Sanskrit as the Bodhicittottapada. And I've given the Sanskrit deliberately because the different translations in the different translations of the Dual Liberation are rather weak. You've got adoption of bodhicitta, cultivation of bodhicitta, or acquisition of an enlightened attitude. They say something, but really it's not really enough. It's quite clear from looking at Gampopa, who bases himself on the Indo-Tibetan Buddhist tradition, it's quite clear that the arising of this mind and heart, completely focused and intent on enlightenment for all beings, is the giving rise to a powerful and surging intention to attain liberation for all beings. And in that sense, it's identical to the deeper meanings of going for refuge. And Gampopa's discussion of bodhicitta takes about 30 pages in Herbert Gunter's translation. So there's a lot of it. He talks about, at the beginning of his discussion, he talks about the nature of the Buddha, of the bodhicitta, this surging towards enlightenment, how it grows and unfolds and thrives. And he gives no less than 22 similes to describe it. He also talks about how we give rise to it, the different ceremonies of the different traditions of taking what's called the Bodhisattva vow, the benefits of it. It's a very thorough discussion, and it's impossible now to explore every aspect of it. So I'm going to be doing some selecting. First of all, let's look at the definition. Gampopa mentions two aspects of bodhicitta in defining it. First of all, there's what's known as the relative bodhicitta, the relative mind intent on enlightenment for all beings. This describes how the bodhicitta works and manifests in life. Sometimes, some of you who've read a bit about Buddhism, you might come across these terms, relative and absolute. And because of our previous religious conditioning, we can sometimes think, relative lower, absolute higher, relative inferior, absolute superior. Therefore, I'm up for the absolute. I want the superior path. That's a very, very profound misunderstanding. Doesn't work like that at all. It's much more like the relative is what you can actually see, what is going on in this life, how it's actually working itself out. And the absolute, the real meaning of that, is its ultimate meaning, its ultimate nature. So the essence of this relative bodhicitta is the overwhelming desire to attain enlightenment so that you may really be able to work for the benefit of others. The overwhelming desire to attain enlightenment so that you may really be able to work for the benefit of others. You've seen that enlightenment a little bit. You've had a sort of taste of liberation. You've seen, glimpsed, intuited, whatever you want to call it, the end of all bewilderment. You really do see that that's the solution to suffering, not just your own suffering, but the suffering of everybody. So you desire from the bottom of your heart, you long from the bottom of your heart for the wisdom of liberation, so that you can really help others, so that you can provide them with the means to liberation. So it's then that Gampopa gives the similes for the bodhicitta, no less than 22 following Indian Buddhist tradition. He likens the bodhicitta to the earth, to gold, to the moon, to fire, to a great song, to a king, to a river, to a cloud, to an echo. I won't go into them. It's really rather lovely. They're very beautiful. And yes, these similes just show the way in which this bodhicitta grows and thrives in us as you perfect the trainings that come with it, what are called the six paramitas or perfections that we'll be looking at tomorrow and later. You're becoming, in other words, through this bodhicitta, the arising of this bodhicitta, a deeper and richer and broader being. You're deepening in wisdom, you're becoming rich with loving kindness and compassion, and you're becoming broader with skills to connect with all kinds of people, all kinds of beings. You're aiming to be, in the end, what Sangharakshita calls a transpersonal stream of spiritual consciousness. You're aiming to be the stream of wisdom and compassion, connecting people with the Dharma, sparking them off, connecting them with the means to liberation. So the bodhicitta is not simply the giving rise to the overwhelming desire to gain enlightenment for all beings. Gambopa also speaks of the ultimate meaning of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta in its ultimate depth, if you like. And his description of this is very beautiful, following an ancient Buddhist text. What is the ultimately real bodhicitta? It is shunyata, emptiness, endowed with the essence of compassion, radiant, unshakable, and impossible to formulate by concepts and speech. It is like the steady glow of a lamp on a calm night. So the bodhicitta isn't about egotistically thinking of yourself as a great saviour of others, you know, the sort of thing. It doesn't involve looking up, down on others from a great compassionate height. That, of course, that's not really compassion at all. The bodhicitta, the mind set on enlightenment, isn't yours. You don't think in that way. It's more like there's been a glimpse, a sense of a vast, open, empty consciousness, radiant and luminous with love and compassion. It's not yours, and it's not somebody else's either. It's impossible to locate it. And it comes with tremendous energy. So, because of that energy, that movement, one takes the vow to liberate all beings from suffering, the vow to gain enlightenment for all beings. So this vow isn't any ordinary vow. It proceeds from a very deep dimension indeed. And in one embarks on the extensive practice of the six paramitas, the perfections of generosity, ethics, patience, vigour, meditation, and finally wisdom. And as I've said, we'll be looking at these perfections in the remaining talks. But I want to end by looking just a little at the practices Gampopa recommends to engender the arising of this bodhicitta and the taking of the bodhisattva vow. And he mentions a number of practices coming from different traditions from India that were extant in Tibet. One of these, you'd be interested to know, is the Sevenfold Puja, the practice that we do every evening. That is a ceremony, a ritual to engender attitudes and responses which give rise to bodhicitta. And Gampopa explains these in quite a lot of detail. And it's quite clear that these attitudes, these moods, these emotional responses aren't just a ceremony. They're something to be living in our lives. The ceremony is the sort of ritual, the imagining, the poetic imagining of those moods. And he also, Gampopa, lays great stress on the confession of fault section of the puja. He goes into that in a lot of detail. The laying bare of and the giving up of and the going forth from what interferes with our bodhicitta, with our spiritual development. I'm mentioning this because we have, just to get you thinking a bit, because on New Year's Eve, we always have here a New Year's Eve ritual. And within that, we have a kind of ritual burning of things that we want to go forth from. You just write on a little bit of paper things that you feel are interfering with your life, which you do yourself, and that you want to sort of have done with. We'll say more about it later, but maybe you might start thinking about that, maybe noting some things down. But I won't look at the puja or confession, because we're doing the puja. What I want to look at is a short passage that Gampopa quotes that lists the four causes that give rise to the bodhicitta, four conditions that lead to the arising of the bodhicitta. And Gampopa derives this from a very influential Buddhist text from the 4th century called the Bodhisattva Bhumi, the stages of a bodhisattva composed by a sangha. And the fact that causes and conditions are mentioned again reminds us that spiritual unfoldment, spiritual experience of any kind, does not arise of itself. It emerges, it unfolds, it arises out of causes and conditions. The causes and conditions that we generate and attend to. Remember, samsara is notorious for being without end. It won't end of itself. So first of all, Gampopa says, following this old tradition, you must be part of, or you must possess the right, the best family or lineage. Now this sounds rather strange. I mean, I think of my own family. They're very nice people, my own family, but anyway. The term here is gotra, which can mean something like family, lineage, or clan, gotra. But Gampopa defines this term as seed, or element, or nature. And this idea of gotra relates to the Buddha potential that we were talking about yesterday. Yesterday we saw that for Gampopa, for the whole Buddhist tradition, all beings possess the potential to become Buddhas. All of us have this extraordinary potential to awaken the fullness of wisdom and compassion. But that potential needs to be activated. It needs to be alive. So the notion of gotra, in fact, is very simple. It's just pointing to that fact. It's not enough that we have this wonderful potential. It needs to be visible. It needs to be active. It needs to be operating. It needs to be effective in our lives. You know, sometimes you might hear somebody saying, but he's got wonderful potential. Yes, I know he's unpleasant, but he's got wonderful potential. Well, yeah, but unless the wonderful potential is happening, it might just as well not be there. So gotra is pointing to the fact that our potential needs to be activated. So it's about not squandering our potential. According to Gampopa, that potential is activated by the material that he covered in the first 8 chapters of the Dual Ornament of Liberation. So let me just remind you of those, how we activate our potential. We do so by recognizing deeply that this human life offers us a very wonderful opportunity, a very precious opportunity. It's a working basis for liberation because we have the freedoms and riches to live in the most meaningful way. Secondly, we need spiritual friends, especially ordinary human spiritual friends, to urge us on and encourage us and guide us. Thirdly, this life is profoundly, deeply impermanent and transitory. Death is inevitable and its time is uncertain. So we need to make the most of the time that we have. Shantideva, a great writer on the bodhicitta, describes this precious human life as being like a lightning flash, lighting up things just for a moment. It opens up life just for a moment. So let's make the most of it right now. Thirdly, we need to be clear about the sufferings and the unsatisfactoriness of life, not to make us feel miserable, but to see in particular that certain kinds of action, unskillful action that we do, causes pain for ourselves and others, and skillful action leads to happiness and well-being for both ourselves and others. Fourthly, we need to cultivate love and compassion for others. I'll say a bit more about this later. And fifthly, we need to go for refuge, be seriously committed to the spiritual life. So these are the ways we awaken our spiritual potential. These are the ways we keep it alive and vibrant and active. And in this way, we are part of the right, the best gotra, the best clan, the best lineage. Lineage has got nothing to do with blood relations. Secondly, the second condition for the arising of the bodhicitta is to fully attend the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, and the spiritual friends. This means bringing vividly to mind our sources of spiritual inspiration in all their glory and beauty. It means contemplating the qualities of the enlightened ones. For example, studying the life of the Buddha. Just simply looking at the oldest records, at the simple stories, the very beautiful stories, you see how a wise and compassionate man behaves in relation to ordinary people, people like ourselves. So that could be a way of attending to the Buddhas. It could be gazing at paintings and images of the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas here being the archetypes of enlightenment that represent the different qualities of enlightenment. It's why Buddhist art is so important, because Buddhist art is an attempt to put into form and colour the beauty and glory of the qualities of enlightenment. There are even meditations where you visualise mentally these different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, to attend to them, to gain inspiration for your practice. Then there's puja. In the puja, that's a way of attending the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's a way of entering a kind of communication with the symbols of enlightenment, developing a kind of relationship, if you like, with those symbols. You're ritually enacting that communication, that interaction with them. It's all done to bring the qualities of enlightenment more vividly into consciousness. Gampopa also mentions attending spiritual friends, coming together with them to study, to practice, to meditate, to perform puja together, to explore the spiritual life together in an atmosphere of friendliness and honesty. Sangharakshita said that the bodhicitta, the heart mind utterly devoted to wisdom and compassion, is more likely to arise in a spiritual community, in a sangha, than in just one lone individual. A sangha of spiritual friends magnifies and amplifies our individual efforts. I'm sure you've felt that sometimes in the meditation sessions in here. And, you know, when it really happens, when you have a number of people really living it together, something extraordinary can arise for the benefit of others. Attending also means serving. Serving the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas and spiritual friends, in the sense of helping them with their bodhisattva work, doing whatever you can to enable the Dharma to be more widely known. Thirdly, the third condition for the arising of bodhicitta is cultivating love and compassion for all living beings. Now, I think this means, first of all, just developing metta, just developing friendliness, being a friendly, kindly, helpful, tender-hearted person to everyone you meet all the time. That's the aim. I think we need to establish that before thinking about being compassionate. I must say, I keep using this word compassion because it's in the text, but I'm very uneasy using it. I think it's very hard to understand compassion in the Buddhist context, and so easy to become sentimental, have sentimental ideas about compassion, or going around self-importantly helping people, which means imposing yourself on people. So I think, first of all, we need to cultivate a real straightforward human friendliness, clean and clear, no strings attached. And when you have that up and running, when that actually encounters another's pain and suffering, that will naturally become compassion, which is simply responding, helping them quickly and effectively. So metta bhavana itself is a very important spiritual practice. In fact, the metta bhavana, if you just concentrate on that, you'd have the whole of the path. You'd give rise to bodhicitta. There's an ancient Buddhist text where the Buddha describes what success in the metta bhavana means. He says, whether he walks, sits, stands, or lies down, he is ever awake to wielding this magical spiritual force of loving kindness. This is the greatest state of being. So this is a condition for the arising of the bodhicitta. And fourthly, there's fearlessness. And by fearlessness, Gampopa means fearlessness in relation to the sufferings of samsara, And also fearlessness in relation to the demands and challenges of living a spiritual life, no matter how long and how difficult that life is. Fearlessness means being completely free of fear. And I think that's asking a lot of us to begin with. It's a lot to ask. You'd have to be enlightened to be completely fearless, because to be completely fearless means to be without any egotism at all. That's when you're completely without fear. But we can cultivate courage, at least. Whatever the challenges, the demands, and however frightening they might appear to be, we carry on. We carry on. We keep acting according to our deepest values, whatever the threat, internal threat, external threat. And fearlessness and courage are emphasised very strongly in Buddhist tradition, especially in the traditions concerned with this Bodhisattva path. The Bodhisattva is depicted so often as a compassionate hero, a warrior, resourceful, determined, able to take responsibility, prompt, responsive. But it must be stressed, it's not a kind of, you know, machismo kind of heroism and warriorhood. Neither is the Bodhisattva a saviour, neither is he a martyr. None of those things are implied. It doesn't go around weighed down by the demands of others. It's not about acting out of guilt or anxiety. The Bodhisattva's courage comes from a rich and open and tender heart. One Buddhist writer has described the path of the Bodhisattva as the open way, because the Bodhisattva is just so open, so tender-hearted, but also very determined. So the courage is more like that of the artist who works regardless of hardship and difficulty. He's just so in love with the work. So we need to cultivate courage in our spiritual practice, not pulling back out of fear, not pulling back from our meditation, our studies, our living of the Buddhist life, or when we're with difficult people in difficult situations. We look to draw on deep spiritual resources, the support of spiritual friends, and that magic power of loving kindness. So these four conditions give rise to the bodhicitta, the mind and heart set upon enlightenment for all beings, awakening our spiritual potential and keeping it awake, attending Buddhas, Bodhisattvas and spiritual friends, cultivating love and compassion, and cultivating fearlessness and courage and determination and energy. And it said, when the bodhicitta arises and when you take that vow to be a bodhisattva, there's tremendous release of energy and there's a great expansion of being and consciousness. So Gampopa tells us, when someone commits themselves to this bodhisattva path, there is a spreading of great joy and happiness. There is a spreading of great joy and happiness at the vision of liberation that has opened up, not for oneself alone, but for the benefit of all beings. So Shantideva speaks of it as the spreading out of a great happiness banquet for all beings. And the first bodhisattva stage, indeed, which arises at this time, is called the pramudita. The pramudita. There he is. The pramudita. The extremely joyful. And the particular practice that you take up then is that of dana, generosity. And we'll be looking at that tomorrow.